Blog Talk Radio.
We're into the spring months, and wow, it's feeling great out here in California. I was just looking at a series of photographs that were published in the San Francisco Chronicle out here, and the reservoirs, the lakes, the rivers are full. So even though they're saying that we haven't really got up to our quota, you know, it's nice to see that our water supply has been replenished here in California. Those of you that lived in different parts of the United States or around the world that don't have that issue, you know, it's I got to tell you, we've had drought here for 4+ years, and I mean, I'm very water focused anyhow, and conserve water as much as I can. But I took a drive, and I mentioned this a few months ago, I took a drive up to Mount Shasta to spend a few days climbing the mountain. And actually, the reason I went up there is to acclimate to high elevation, to see how I would do at high elevation in preparation for a trip to Peru, 9,000 feet and higher. And anyhow, when I went up there, I drove by Shasta Lake. And as a kid, I used to, my dad would take us out there, and we'd be playing in the water and everything. And I was completely shocked to see that the lake was bone dry. There were boats that were stuck in the dirt because there was no water. And it was really a shock to me, and it left a monstrous impression on me, not really being affected, living in the San Francisco Bay Area, but living in the California area. I was made aware immediately that we had a water problem. So anyhow, these photographs of Shasta Dam, Shasta Lake, Oroville Lake, Oroville Dam, and a number of other places, Eel River, have been replenished. Now, they're not completely replenished. They're about 80% full. So to predictions of this monstrous El Nino coming in and just flooding everything, were not quite met. Expectations weren't completely met. But we did get enough rain and water supply to make things a lot easier. So anyhow, so I still keep an eye on our water or my water consumption, but it's nice to know that the water in California, at least in the Northern California area, has been replenished. Those who live in Southern California did not get the supply they needed, so they're going to have some issues. And on the subject real quickly, desalination, pulling up seawater, converting it to drinkable water, is something they're doing more and more, even though it's very, very costly in terms of production. Santa Barbara's putting in, I think they're going to start their desalination system soon. LA could use a couple of those systems too, even though they're about $1 billion+ to put in operation. So just something to think about. Water, water, water. Water is life. Water is amazing. Water is important. So there you go. Hey, I mentioned last week I was going to name the winner of the Graham Hancock book, Magicians of the Gods. The winner is Christopher Lewis, who lives in Illinois. And he was the closest to come to 363, which was the number that I wrote and placed in an envelope a few months ago. So Christopher Lewis, congratulations. You'll get the book. I'll be sending it out to you next week. And I hope you enjoy it. Magicians of the Gods is the follow-up to Fingerprints of the Gods, which is just an amazing book. By the way, Graham Hancock's going to be here in June to follow up on his road trip to promote Magicians of the Gods. He's going to talk specifically with us about some of the ancient ruins and their significance. I'm looking forward to that. So Graham will be with us in June. I want you to always be looking at our Facebook page. And this week I have two very important galleries. And each day, members are posting information, and photo galleries on the Facebook page. And I'm really happy that I have a large membership of people who are really totally into the same stuff I'm into, or close to it. Always going to be the UFO alien stuff when you're on Facebook, and you're talking about ancient civilizations. But I try to steer a little away from that and kind of get into some grounded material. But one of the most interesting galleries I want to talk about real quickly is a gallery I posted called Ancient Technology. And what's very unusual about this, and actually we've had people on the show who've talked about machines from the ancient past, is that the gallery is filled with examples of saw marks, drilling, and cutting machinery that we have no evidence for, but we can see it in what was left. And perhaps some of the most important and most revealing images are of where a machine operator, a saw operator, cut into granite and then pulled out quickly, leaving the traces of his saw. And I'd say this gallery is probably about 100 images, and over a third of them are examples of saw cuts. And this is really revealing. And Chris Dunn talks quite a bit about this in his book, Ancient Technology of Egypt, where somebody, a craftsman, construction worker, was cutting stone and just left the rough edges of it, open so that you can see how the blade cut into the rock and then was removed once the rock was cut and cut in two or whatever. So that's on that's Facebook, Ancient Aliens. The gallery is called Ancient Technology. It's over 100 photographs. Probably one of the best groups of images I've seen, simply because of the fact that these are high-powered, high-velocity machines that are cutting, sawing, drilling, boring, whatever you want to call it, into solid rock. Where this technology has gone, we don't know. It would be great to find some kind of a power machine someday, but who knows if this is going to happen or not. So check that out. The other thing is, I have a gallery of images from Pumapunku, Bolivia, and also Tiwanaku, which is the major city in that area. And this is provided by one of the members, and this is one of the most comprehensive images or excuse me, galleries of this ancient city that I've ever seen. Over 400 detailed images collected from people like Chris Dunn and a whole bunch of other people for you to look at. And I really would suggest you take a look at it if you're listening along and you want to know more details about the about ancient civilizations. Pumapunku is just a fascinating place. And they don't know how it was built. I mean, there's solid stone that's cut such in a level of detail that we just don't understand. So Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group page. I also posted it on the international page. And this is what we're all about. We want you to see what we're talking about. And if you can, get, you know, also buy a book from these guys too. So check that out on Facebook. Today's interview with Georgios Sokalos is was recorded a few days ago. And I had a lot of fun with Giorgio simply because he believes ardently that ancient aliens have come and basically spawned our civilizations. So this is a pretty thorough interview. We have a lot to agree on in this interview, conversation, I'm going to say. I had a lot of fun with him. I was amazed to discover that the show is in its 11th season. 11 years they've been promoting it. And if you do watch Ancient Aliens, I think you'll find this a fun interview. So here it is, and I'll come back at the end. We've talked with a number of people who are influenced, who write about ancient aliens, who report about them. We've had Mike Barra on the show. We've had Jason Martell. David Hatcher Childress has spoken a number of times. But the phenomenon known as ancient aliens has just grown tremendously. And it has more than a million people watching each week. And the show is just, it just blossomed. And I'm really, really fortunate and happy to have Georgios Sokalos on the show today. And he is the host. He is the host of the program, and he's a consulting producer. I want to just tell you a little bit about him. I have known about Giorgio for a while. He is the, he also publishes Legendary Times magazine. And he is, we're going to ask him about this in a second, but I would say he is a disciple of Eric Verdonighan and his work. I didn't know this, but for 14 years, he was affiliated with Eric Verdonighan and his Ancient Alien Society. But as you listeners know, we're always interested in information. We're always interested in the latest research. A lot of the people that we have on our show are cutting edge, and it just makes sense to have Giorgio on the program. So, Giorgio, welcome to Earth Ancients. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
It's great to have you with us. I really appreciate you taking the time. I want to go over a few points in your personal history. You've been affiliated with Eric Verdonighan for a number of years. Would you say that you've always been kind of a proponent of the theories of Eric Verdonighan, or was it more that you supported his work and you had your own kind of insights into an influence from off-world people?
Eric Verdonighan most certainly has been my inspiration for everything that I do today. There's no doubt in my mind about that. However, I am not in any way, shape, or form his disciple, because being a disciple implies that Eric would be a type of savior, and it has this religious connotation. So in any way he was or is my mentor, and above anything else, one of the closest and dearest friends I've known. And, you know, so I, when I grew up, it just so happened that the first inspiration for all these topics actually came through my grandmother. And so whenever my grandma would visit from Austria, these ideas of extraterrestrial life and past civilizations and Atlantis and things like that, they would become dinner table conversations in our household. So I was exposed to these ideas at a very young age. And then I remember buying a book by Eric for my dad for his birthday, and my dad looked at it, read it, and said, "Oh, it's very interesting." And I took the book myself, and I read the thing. I think it was on a Sunday afternoon, from the first to the last page in one sitting, and I was done for because it was one of the most compelling things I had ever read. And you know, it was when I was 15, 14 that I consciously began to put two and two together.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just looking at the date that Chariots of the God came out in 1968. And I think I still have in my bookshelf a copy of that book because I scribbled in it, and I felt the same way. I was totally flabbergasted. I was like, "This is amazing." I think there's a sense of what Eric was trying to convey in that book over 48 years ago of some kind of an influence. Do you think since that time, obviously you've been doing the Ancient Alien series, do you think There's a lot of evolution in the 48 years since that book came out that there's more evidence for alien contact? Ancient alien
Absolutely.
Contact, that is. Yeah.
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing that, you know, with all these new discoveries that we are now making in science, a lot of the things that Eric talked about are being corroborated. I mean, all these new discoveries that we are making in the fields of genetics, of artificial mutation of genes and things like that. This is all stuff that Eric talked about in the 60s and 70s, and they turn out that, you know, many of these things that he theorized about were not necessarily science fiction, but science fact. And there are so many things that we are now, you know, almost on a weekly basis that are discovering in astronomy. For example, with the gravitational waves and this new additional planet that allegedly is in this huge orbit around our sun, you know, things that the Sumerians talked about, you know, thousands of years ago, all these things are being corroborated with modern science. So has it been a slow process? Absolutely. But has the ancient astronaut theory in any way, shape, or form lost its appeal or its strength in evidence? No, on the contrary, it has gotten only stronger.
Yeah, it's true. You have and by the way, is Ancient Aliens in its 10th year coming up, or what is the story with that? There's some confusion about it being restarted, or is it still going to happen? What do we know about the following season on the program?
Yeah, no, we are now actually going into, I think it's season 11 or something like that. But, you know, I've lost count of the seasons because sometimes the network, they count seasons differently than the production company does. All I can tell you is that we are well over 100 episodes, and I think we are with the episodes that we are filming right now, we are, I think, at 110 or 112 episodes. So very exciting. And, you know, the other great thing or cool thing is that Ancient Aliens is back on the History Channel. And the new episodes will premiere sometime this coming May.
Fantastic. You know, I have to ask you, I know you are close with Eric. Did he ever tell you what influenced him? Because I don't think I've ever found any writings about what was a trigger point for him, if he was on an exploration or what. But it'd be really interesting to know what he was, what was his influence.
Absolutely, and he's actually been quite vocal about how this interest for these ideas came about, or how he got exposed to them. And that is when he was a young boy. He was sent to a Jesuit boarding school in Switzerland, in the French-speaking part of Switzerland, in Fribourg. and that boarding school, which was led by Jesuit priests, you know, he had to go, or he was made to study ancient Greek and Latin, and so they many of their homework assignments consisted of having to translate Bible passages from the Latin into Greek and the Greek into Latin, vice versa, into German or actually into French and things like that. And Eric says that during these translations, doubt came up in his young mind, where he would read these passages about, you know, an allegedly all-benevolent, all-knowing God making mistakes, or, you know, not knowing what the outcome would be. And as a young kid, he would be asking himself, well, what kind of a God is this that wouldn't know the outcome, or they would have to wait to see what would happen? Well, if God is all-knowing and all-powerful and things like that, it shouldn't matter. So the idea then came to his mind, or the question then in his mind was, well, if this is not necessarily God, then who else or what could it have been? And here is something very important, that to this day, and this is very important to all of our listeners, to this day, Eric says that he is a believer in God, in an all-encompassing force in the universe, this harmonics field that we all belong to. However, the God, or whatever is described in the Bible, wasn't necessarily that harmonics force, this field, but it was a flesh and blood extraterrestrial whom our ancestors mistakenly identified as God, or as gods. And that was just, you know, it was a mistake.
Yeah. So much of our history is influenced by unknown figures like that. And I think a lot, and that's just my opinion, that Ancient Aliens kind of has that as a focus, which is supreme beings of advanced scientific knowledge who came down. And because they were so far in advance of Earthlings or whoever was on the planet at that time, that they were considered gods. And that whole premise works quite a bit for the program, but I'm just curious. Would you say that's the foundation? Is these advanced beings coming down and basically enlightening us here?
Yes, because that is the basic premise of the ancient astronaut theory. That at some point, the ancient astronaut theory tries to prove whether or not intelligent extraterrestrials, flesh and blood physical beings, visited Earth in the remote past. And in doing so, when they were here in the remote past, they encountered that one of our human ancestors had potential. And so through a artificial mutation of our genes, they essentially created or gave us intelligence. And so the idea is that we are in a way their creation through this genetic mutation of our genes, even though there is a clear fossil record. But even geneticists and Darwin himself said that, you know, the theory of evolution is fantastic, I like it, but there's something missing, and that is why today we are all talking about this missing link. Something doesn't make sense. The equation does not the equation doesn't solve itself. So what's the missing link? The missing link, for some have proposed, is coincidence or something like that, and some have proposed, oh, it's God, you know, an intelligent designer, creationism. But, you know, neither side, in my opinion, it holds that truth, because what if it's the middle? What if it is a genetic mutation of our genes, but it wasn't God? It happened in a lab with extraterrestrials, you know, who wanted to essentially colonize or allow this planet to be colonized.
Okay, that fits into the Sitchin theory then, like the Anunnaki, right?
Well, the Sitchin theory suggested that we were created as a species or as a race, a slave race, that we were built or made so that we would mine the gold for, you know, the Anunnaki. And while that may have been the case, I personally disagree with that notion, because this whole idea that we were created in the first place as slaves, I highly, highly find that a very unattractive thought.
Yeah, I know. It is kind of funny to think that we were created to be mining stuff. I know for a fact, in my visits with the Mayan elders, that they have a whole history of star people influence. And so do the Zuni, so do the Hopi. We've had Clifford Mahody on our show. I think he was on Ancient Aliens one time, also talking about star people. But I have to ask you this. Wouldn't it be important for an advanced civilization, thousands of years of in advance of our own culture, to have, and this is shades of Star Trek, kind of a prime directive not to over, you know, influence a society that's developing on its own? Wouldn't it make sense? I mean, it's kind of funny that Gene Roddenberry came up with that prime directive, but it kind of makes sense if you're 1,000 or 2,000 years advance of a simple people living on the planet, kind of focused on the earth. What do you think about that idea?
Well, here's the thing, and I'm so glad you bring this up, because this all ties into the whole idea of the cargo cult phenomenon. And, you know, Gene Roddenberry certainly was a visionary with the whole idea of the prime directive, but I think that the prime directive only applies to, or should only apply to, civilizations that are as advanced, as technologically speaking, as we are today, because in a certain way, we are right now at this bizarre crossroads where, if they were to show themselves publicly, the ETs that is, right at this moment, I'm not sure how it would go, whether, you know, there would be mass panic or not. So I'm unsure how to answer or how to, you know, observe that question.
Yeah.
But, you know, this whole idea, you know, of I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Walked in.
The prime directive and what the influence would
be. The prime directive. See, I think that while the prime directive is a wonderful philosophical idea, let's just imagine for a moment if we as a human species 1,000 years or 2,000 years in the future arrive at a distant planet, and we see that this distant planet hosts some type of intelligent life, but that intelligent life is not yet advanced technologically speaking. What will we do? Will we just stand back and watch them from afar? Sure, maybe for a couple of months or for a little while. But then we'll make the conscious decision to help these people, to guide them in a technological direction, to teach them a few things in astronomy, in agriculture, engineering, all those different things, perfectly knowing that in the far and distant future of that planet, we humans that have arrived at that planet will become ancient astronauts in their mythologies.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the idea of this whole, you know, why this prime directive won't work in the sense of Gene Roddenberry, because I think that especially if there's a primitive society that has potential and you can descend from the stars in order to help that society, I mean, that's beautiful. It's amazing. It's actually helping another planet to go and to walk into the future. So, you know, this whole prime directive thing, I always say, and I mention it a lot in my lectures, you know, it's a great idea for science fiction, but not for reality.
Well, that leads me to my next question. You know, Ancient Aliens films in different parts of the world, and the production quality is very good. And I mean, some of the panoramic shots and the shots of the ruins and things like that are just amazing. But, you know, you go to Egypt, you go to Lebanon, and in each of those places are very ancient cultures, the ancient Egyptians and the people who built Belbach and the gigantic remains of stonework and handiwork that are just mind-blowing. We can't really figure it out. But I guess I want to consider it Earth humans that did this. And the reason I bring this up is we now know that there was an event approximately 10,000 years ago known as the Younger Dryas event, which are catastrophic Earth-changing events where we were hit with multiple asteroids, which caused, you know, heating of the planet, tsunamis, basically, we think, wiping the planet clean of any humanoid or animal life. But before that event, there's speculation by people like Graham Hancock and a number of authors out there that there were civilized people, and we don't know to the level of civilization they were at, but there's a good opportunity, a good chance that they were very highly advanced. And to say that these megaliths, especially at Belbok, I mean, one of those gigantic stones that's still in place that hasn't been cut up free is about 800 or 1,000 tons.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, and this is the other thing, Giorgio, is there's researchers out there. There's a guy who passed away. His name was John Burt. And he discovered that these ancient people used electromagnetic fields to pass and amplify through pyramidal structures. And we know this through Tikal. We know it through various American sites. I think he even went to the Great Pyramid in Giza and did some analysis. So there's like a missing link with technology. And I think, you know, it's cool to say, hey, maybe these were aliens, but it's even cooler to think there was a branch of humanoids that actually may have used this technology. Don't you have a feeling for that?
Well, first of all, I personally have never said, not once, that the ancient monuments were built by aliens. That's the meme, not me. I certainly have never said nor suggested that the pyramids at Giza or, you know, the Colosseum in Rome and things like that, that was built by aliens. They weren't. These were all built by human beings under the tutelage of extraterrestrial visitors. And the reason why I am suggesting that this happened, that the engineering knowledge was given to our ancestors, is because of those stories in mythologies that we can read about the guardians of the sky, or the watchers, or the people that were dwelling up in the clouds, leading humankind into the future. So this is the idea. That, and by the way, I love the idea that Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock, whom I consider colleagues, by the way, that those theories that they have proposed, because these theories do not at all negate the extraterrestrial question. Because if, let's say, there was a high culture 12,500 BC during the golden age of the ancient Egyptians, they still talk about the gods descending in these winged discs from the sky. So whether the extraterrestrials were here 5,000 years ago or 12,000 years ago, I don't care. All I care about is that they're, you know, to figure out if they were here. And in my opinion, they were. And this also, by the way, delves into the whole question that I'm sometimes asked, well, do you think that these visitors were just us from the future, that we went back there to save us or something like this? And
yeah,
you know, thank you for laughing, because see, the thing is that in all of my studies of the ancient texts, I have yet to come across a passage that says, we are you from the future. Now, if somebody can find me that passage, then, you know, I'll gladly concede and say, all right, it could be time travel. But that is the only reason why I'm standing back from that, because I know what I've read about what our ancestors told or said about those beings descending from the sky. They never said that we're you from the future. They always said, you know, we're from out there.
That's funny that you mentioned that, because I haven't run across any of that, but I imagine that you on your tour schedule and your lectures get every possible conceived idea about the future, the aliens, influences.
Oh my gosh,
like
are you kidding
stuff.
Me? It's very stimulating. Yeah. I love it. I enjoy listening to all the different opinions. It keeps my day very entertaining, let me tell you.
I would think so. I think you have a charmed life, Giorgio. I want to ask you, of all the places that Ancient Alien goes to, the series, what would you say are the best examples of a city that is heavily influenced by an alien intervention? I mean, do we know? Do you have, like, I keep thinking Pumapunku because of just the magnificent carving, and I'm sure you've heard of the work or read the work of Christopher Dunn, who went up there, who's an engineer and actually did analysis of these stones. And for many, many years, they thought they were poured concrete, and they're actually andesite, which is extremely hard rock that's been carved. So, but I'm just curious, what is a best case example of a city that you think is an influence from direct alien intervention?
Yes, no, you hit the nail on the head, no question. Pumapunku is the place, and that's a site in Bolivia. It's part of a larger site known as Tiwanaku, and it's in the high in the Andean Plateau. So we're at an altitude of about 12,500 feet. The air is rarefied. It can get very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter, and you know, hot during the day and cold at night. It's very arid, and up there, like you mentioned, is this bizarre place where many of the blocks there consist of andesite, and they are so perfectly cut that one has to wonder how it was done, and also how some of these blocks were transported, because, look, the great majority of the blocks up there are, in fact, red sandstone, and you can tell it's the sandstone pieces because you can see their deep burgundy coloration, which indicates it's the sandstone. However, speckled throughout these red pieces are pieces that look black or rather gray. And that gray is, like you said, andesite. And that is igneous rocks. It's one of the hardest rocks you can ever imagine how to be cut. Because here's the thing. I am not interested in I have to repeat this all the time. I am not questioning that our ancestors didn't know how to cut ancient stones in ancient times. Of course they knew how to cut rocks in ancient times. For example, in Greece at Mycenae, there is a wonderful corner of an entrance at the treasury chamber of Atreus. At the bottom, you can see that there was a column there, but the bottom they cut it off sort of squared, and right there you see exactly where the blade went through, whether it was a blade or whether it was some type of a wire saw, I don't know, but you can clearly see the cut. Now, why am I not as impressed with that cut as, for example, something at Pumapunku? Because at Mycenae, all we have is sandstone and very porous, you know, coral rock and things like that. So even if you went with your little finger, with a nail of your little finger, you could scratch something off. But that is impossible with andesite. So if you want to believe that these andesite blocks were cut with the few copper tools that were found at Pumapunku, that's fine. Believe whatever the heck you want. But you cannot cut physically. It's impossible to cut andesite with copper tools or, as some have suggested, chicken bones. So, you know, and that does not even answer the question of transportation, because even if we have, and because there is a 65 andesite block that's just a massive platform, but there are even bigger platforms that are up there that are made of the red sandstone. And remember, like I said, sandstone is easier to cut, but how was a 120-ton block platform moved in and around Pumapunku? Because there never were any trees that could have been cut down, so the tree logs could have been used as wooden rollers, because Pumapunku is situated above the natural tree line. So we have all we have at Pumapunku are giant question marks, because what was a 120-ton block dragged across how? So, see, my colleague David Childress always says, and you've had him on your program, the reason why there are that many ancient gigantic blocks is because at some point the engineering process for creating something like that had to have been easy. Otherwise, it would have never been done. Never.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
So then, you know, so you really, you're going to scratch your head.
Totally, yeah. And the funny thing about that place is that the early engineer Arthur Poznanski dated that site to 17,000 years old, and then he was pretty much, they say that they didn't believe it. He basically used the alignments to the cosmos to calculate that number, but later on they say, no, that's it's closer to a couple thousand years old. But the problem with current archaeology is they don't dig far enough down. And I believe he did actually dig pretty far down and found evidence to a much, much earlier date. So who knows how old that place is. But it is fascinating.
No doubt. What's really cool right now is that, you know, with all the new technologies that we now have, Pumapunku is experiencing a renaissance in discoveries, because they're with ground penetrating radar, they've recently discovered an entire new complex that's underneath the dirt there. I've been to Pumapunku quite a few times, and every time I go back, there are new excavations, new holes in the ground, and sometimes you can look deep into the ground and you see megaliths at the bottom. So something happened there, because no megaliths are buried, 10, 20 feet underground unless something happened. And some have proposed that it may have been some type of a cataclysm, because the evidence also shows that in the entire area there, they found a lot of fossilized old and dead remnants of fish and mussels and shells from the ocean. And that, I mean, that's wild, because the ocean is far away from that area. So is it possible, like what Velikovsky suggested back in the day, that there was a tilt shift of the Earth's axis and things like that? So these are all gigantic questions. And, you know, I always wonder, since when has asking questions become a crime?
You know, this is what's so bothersome for me, is that here's a number of scientists, a number of engineers who are making hypotheses, and in some cases they believe in facts of crust displacement and Earth shifting and tilting, and yet they're put down by current science because it's just too far-fetched for them. But I mean, we don't really have records 10,000 plus years ago, so why is modern science so against the idea of ancient sophisticated societies that are as advanced as we are today, except perhaps the fact that they use more naturally occurring magnetic fields for their energy generation? Do you have any feeling?
Because I think that we inherently, as a society, we are egotistical. Don't we always laugh at previous, civilization or society from 30 years ago or 40 years ago? The 70s, wasn't that quaint? Wasn't that funny? Or the 60s? nudge. So things like that, I guess, the reason why is because Eric always says that it doesn't matter whether you are of the religious conviction or of a scientific conviction. In both cases, at the end, we're both, both camps or both sides are what he refers to as navel gazers. They still look at their navel, or we all look at our navels quite pleased with ourselves, that in the end, after everything is said and done, we are the crown of creation. We're the ultimate. We're, there's nothing better than us in the universe. And, you know, this is what some sociologists and futurologists actually have been theorizing or philosophizing about. You know, the impact of an actual extraterrestrial visit. What would happen? And this German futurologist by the name of Dr. Michael Schoetze, he wrote that we have to ask ourselves some very, very simple questions, and that is, how do we all react if and when we're involved in a home invasion? You know, if somebody all of a sudden, uninvited, stands in your living room, well, I don't think anyone takes lightly to that situation. So that is why it's this big question, too, and the extraterrestrials know this. They have to, they're aware that what would happen or what could happen if they were to show themselves. See, and the other question I'm always asked is, like, for example, when that oil spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico there, I was asked, well, how come the aliens don't swoop down and stuff the hole? And the answer is very simple, because we put the hole there. We are the one, we're the problem. You know, so this attitude that, you know, oh, we'll just have to sit back and let the aliens take care of it. I mean, how egotistical and arrogant is such thinking in the first place? That's why probably they don't want to have anything to do with us anyway, because we're all such spoiled people. It's not even funny.
It's interesting you say that. But wasn't there a study done, the Brownian Institute did a study in the late 60s that if aliens did come down, it would people would freak out, religions would be questioned, and our existence would be, I mean, people would be jumping out of windows and things like that. I think that's our government.
And, you know, right, and I know the studies that you're referring to, because that's exactly right. These predictions were made, and I think that, you know, this is why we have the Disclosure Project that's going on right now. And the Disclosure Project, you know, I'm often asked, so when do you think disclosure is coming? When do you think? Well, you know, in my opinion, disclosure won't be or isn't going to be a press conference, you know, some people in suits, and then it's being broadcast by CNN. I don't think so. Disclosure, if anything, we're in it. It's happening right now, because all those different TV shows like Ancient Aliens or different Hollywood movies and things like that are all about ETs. And, you know, I mean, does it really have to be spelled out? That is a way with which to prepare the masses. And I think that it's a wonderful way with which to ease the fear of the unknown, because that's the other thing. To me, you know, this whole, because I'm always asked, oh, so do you think they're going to come and destroy us? I had no way, because if that would be the case, I think that it would have already happened had they wanted to destroy us. And to wait until now with all of our nuclear capabilities, you know, so I'm not worried about them. I'm worried about us in the first place, what we will do.
Well, they may know that we have a tendency to go to the extreme. And if they came down, somebody might press the nuclear button, and who knows what would happen. So, but I honestly have been interested in the whole alien question for decades. And it does become a frustration with all the research we have. And it's funny, because in America, they're not as widely seen or reported, and it might be editing on the part of government and news media, as much as Mexico. And people like Jaime Maussan, who I know you're familiar with, reports on these amazing ships and crafts that are passing across the air, coming out of the sea and things like that. And it's documented and it's just mind blowing. So you know these guys are around. They're just not stepping out and going, here we are, let's talk.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something is going on, and you know, I don't care what anybody says, but not everyone who has seen something is a liar, and not everyone has seen a damn weather balloon. So, you know, it's this question about you know, whom to believe or whom not to believe. Of course, the question exists because, you know, many people, they just make up stories for attention and things like that. But to label everyone who has had a UFO encounter, whether it is, you know, no matter what type of an encounter, that all of them have invented those stories, I hardly doubt that, because, you know, there are attorneys, medical doctors, pilots, astronauts even, who have come forward to say we have seen something, some even having been personally abducted. Who are we to say that all these stories are fake, or that all these stories are, you know, secret military stuff? Can we just forget it?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I have something
the other thing
I want
to
talk to you. Go ahead.
Sure. Oh, well, the other thing I briefly wanted to mention is that, you know, about these studies of the future regarding what would extraterrestrial visitation, what impact would it have on religion? And my answer to that is very simple. Religion can go on, because if one were to follow the true path of each and every religion there is, which, correct me if I'm wrong, which is love, then, you know, what's wrong with continuing this idea of love and loving thy neighbor as you would love yourself? So, you see, I think this whole extraterrestrial question is very much compatible with religion, even though, for all intents and purposes, the reason why we have religions today in their organized sense is because due to a misunderstood extraterrestrial visit in a remote past, but still, because here's the thing, in my opinion, even extraterrestrials have religious questions. They have questions about life and death, or unless you have become one as an ethereal conscious being and you're one with the universe, yeah, then maybe you know. But, you know, until then, even extraterrestrials have questions like us, because I'm always accused that, or not accused, but mocked by saying, oh, so if you suggest that we've had help from aliens in the past, you know, chuckle, did the aliens, who helped them? Aliens also, chuckle. And the answer is yes, of course. This game has played out for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and perhaps even millions of years throughout our galaxy. And if you then, you know, arrive at the very beginning of this game of, you know, intergalactic seeding, well, however or wherever it started, if there ever was a beginning, then that could be conceived as God. But that's above everything, you see? So so you don't have to lose your belief in God at all if you entertain or subscribe to the ancient astronaut question. It's just all so bizarre, this misconception that, you know, if you subscribe to aliens, you're an atheist. I think it's just the opposite.
That's a real interesting theory. Religion is a
and
big
by and by saying that, I want to be clear that I'm not in any way, shape, or form suggesting that one should worship aliens. No, that's not the point either. On the contrary, we should never bow down if and when they come back.
Interesting. That's fascinating. You know, you mentioned tens of thousands, perhaps millions of years ago, this has been, you know, exchanging of technology, exchanging of information. And we recently had a scientist on our program. He's a fusion scientist. His name is Dr. John Brandenburg. And this
Sure, I know Dr. John. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So he's the expert on Mars. And I actually shot an interview with him for In Search of Aliens, and what a wealth of knowledge that man has. But sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you're piping up about that, because he presented a paper about a year ago where he analyzed and discovered that two massive nuclear bombs were exploded over the planet Mars, basically rendering the complete surface of the planet uninhabitable and possibly punching a hole in the atmosphere, which basically killed the planet. But the point I wanted to make is there has been a number of studies and a number of photographs of what appears to be pyramids, Sphinx-like structures on Mars' surface. We know the whole Cydonia region has, of course, the face, and he has discovered south of there the ellipsis pyramids. The thing that I find fascinating is that I'm wondering if there was an influence there, if the people living on Mars came to Earth who were pre-dynastic Egyptians and may have spawned the whole multiple dynasties, because I mean, and he's predicting, he shows with great evidence these bombs were exploded up, you know, millions of years ago. So that talks about a race that's millions of years ago. I mean, it's just mind blowing what he found out.
It is exactly the way you say. It's mind blowing. And you know, it goes back to what Michael Cremo refers to as extreme antiquity. And so all of a sudden, if you have this new scientific report dating or suggesting that it is possible that atomic bombs were somehow deployed on Mars millions of years ago, all of a sudden these stories of extreme antiquity that one can find in the Mahabharata, for example, or the text that Michael Cremo is familiar with that speak of where he himself has referenced these texts in his book that he wrote with Richard Thompson called Forbidden Archaeology. If you haven't read that book, go get it. Also, there's a shorter version called The Hidden History of the Human Race. It's the abbreviated version of Forbidden Archaeology, because I think Forbidden Archaeology is like 1,000 pages or so.
It's a monster. It's a monster.
But Michael Cremo has always, he's always been an advocate and a huge supporter of extreme antiquity occurrences within our solar system, especially on Earth, obviously. However, I have always thought that if there was contact, that, you know, those visitors came from outside of our own solar system. But over the past 4 or 5 years, because at the beginning of the interview, you asked me the question, how have things evolved and things like that. So guess what? I, too, am a student. I, too, can learn. I, too, wonder every day still. And so by being exposed and being involved with ancient aliens, the idea that at some point Mars was the Earth, and, you know, then because due to a cataclysm or due to some type of a war, we had to, or they had to, leave Mars and colonize the Earth to ensure their survival, and combining that with ancient stories that speak of these things, then, you know, my ears are open. I listen. I think it's highly fascinating to wonder whether or not we are the Martians.
That's
and then you have to wonder, you know, how long has this game been going back and forth? I mean, the other day, you know, we were just interviewing for a new episode in which we explored, you know, the whole idea of our moon, that the moon in its present form is a giant mystery. There should be these questions should be on the front page of the New York Times, but they're not, where, you know, these two Soviet scientists have, their astronomers, they have pretty much proven that the only way that the moon can be in orbit around our Earth is if someone placed the moon there, which means that the moon was brought here artificially. and perhaps the entire moon itself is an artificial object. I mean, these are all crazy ideas. But, you read them, and all you have to do is you have to keep an open mind. And whether or not these things turn out to be true in the end, at least you explored it. Because, to me, life is about exploration. It is the idea of exploring. And then, hey, if it turns out to be the way it is, great. If not, hey, move on.
That's amazing. You mentioned that moon. There was, I think it's a Soviet scientist who believes and has analyzed the Phobos 2 moon on Mars is completely artificial. Completely artificial.
Correct.
And yet we just don't hear anything about it, because if it's true, that's going to blow everyone's mind to smithereens. And they're gonna wonder who was sophisticated enough to build a planetary size ship, basically, that's orbiting Mars. It's crazy.
Right, and so right there, and what better place? You see, yes, of course, I advocate for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence here on Earth. However, there is a scientific research branch that with a handful of professors worldwide, not SETI, but SETA, Search for Extraterrestrial Artifacts. Now, like I said, I look for this stuff, for artifacts and evidence here on Earth. The SETA scientists, even though I've written to them and spoken to them multiple times that they should expand their search on Earth as well, they're only looking for evidence within our solar system off-planet, meaning anywhere else but Earth. And so, Phobos is very interesting because it would be a perfect thing or object with which to observe the Earth. Or there are these points where you could place a probe inside what's called a Lagrange point. And the Lagrange points are insofar important because there's no gravitational pull that is exerted upon these points, and so you can place something there, and it would just stay there. So those Lagrange points are all known within our solar system. So, one idea was to, once we have the capability, to have a spaceship go to these different Lagrange points to see if maybe some artificial objects are parked there, to see if we're being observed. But, those are all things that we're still... I think we're a couple of years away from being able to do that.
Interesting. I got a couple more questions, and then we'll be into our program here. We're running out of time. It's fantastic. And I don't know if you have covered this, but I am constantly getting information on these objects that were found in Mexico. They're carvings, they're figurines, and they portray what looks to be aliens with slanted eyes. There's a number of pieces that have saucers in them depicted, and there's a couple that have ships that are shooting rays out at the various objects. And this information has been going on for about 5 or 6 years. There was rumor that the Mexican government was going to claim that these are the proof of ancient aliens in Mexico, and this has been going back and forth and back and forth. I'm on the fence with it, but I was just curious what you thought about those. I mean, because we're talking hundreds of these artifacts now.
Right. I know which artifacts you're referring to, and I, too, am on the fence. And I say this simply because of, I have come in contact with many ancient artifacts all around the world. And there's a certain look to ancient artifacts that I've grown to be familiar with. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that you're referring to is, it's too shiny. It's too greasy looking. So it's not, it doesn't look authentic or old to me, even though, on the record, I do not know whether these things are authentic. And I have also not seen any scientific testing because, for example, we know now for a fact that many of the Inca stones that were or are displayed at the Cabrera Museum in Paracas, in Ica, Peru, not the rock as it's outside, but in Ica, Peru, that some of those stones are in fact modern forgeries. But that is only half of the story. The other stones, some have been tested, and the patina, the layer, the oxidized layer that was found on the surface of some of these stones indicate a high age of at least 500 to 800 years old. So you have, you know, carvings or stones like that with bizarre carvings on them. Well, then you have to wonder what's going on, because, you know, there are many carvings and figurines and objects around the world that, in my opinion, are old, ancient, that do look like the stuff that you're talking about. But they have been authenticated as being old. And in those cases, I have no problem in pointing to those different pieces and say, yep, that right there could be an astronaut as it was witnessed by our ancestors. And of course, then I'm always asked, well, how come those ancient astronauts wore the same type of bulky suits that with which we are familiar with today and things like that? And, you know, I mean, I don't know, because we don't go to space naked either. You know, so, idea that just because they're extraterrestrials, that they can walk around or saunter around naked, I mean, that makes no sense, because I think the laws of biology, in my opinion, apply throughout the universe. And while there may be, intelligence somewhere, you know, walking upright lobsters made out of cardboard, you know, maybe that exists somewhere in the universe. I don't know. But that's not the extraterrestrial life I'm interested in. I think that when the hatch opens and they come out, we'll be looking at ourselves. And that will be the biggest reveal in the history of mankind. That, you know, it's not going to be, in my opinion, what they portray. Which, look, it's a funny, you know, cool action-oriented idea, and, you know, the whole Hollywood thing of aliens.
Yeah.
But I think, like I said, when the hatch opens, if there is a hatch, then we'll be looking at ourselves in the mirror.
That's pretty pretty cool to consider. Hey, the last question I have for you is that presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton recently said that Earth may already have been visited, and she promises to get to the bottom of the alien controversy. We've had other presidents talk about this. Jimmy Carter promised that he would get in, out and open up the files for evidence of contact of any kind of technology exchange. What do you think about our government and having Clinton, if she is elected president, to open some of these vaulted doors?
No, that would be fantastic if that could happen. What's also interesting is that Podesta, just the other day, I think it was on Friday or Saturday, said that he thinks that the American public could handle the truth about extraterrestrials. And I wholeheartedly agree with him, because, you know, see, this is why I think that there is this, we are at this bizarre crossroads at the moment where, you know, and we already talked about this a few minutes ago, but, you know, 20 years ago, the planet may have broken out in panic had they shown up. Today, it's different, in my opinion, even though, you know, we cannot forget that there are certain parts of this world where, you know, people still go to witch doctors. And so imagine cultures where being told that, hey, extraterrestrials just descended from the sky. I mean, that would all be overwhelming for a lot of people, and of course also for the religious people, because how will they react? And this is why we addressed this issue earlier. I think even people from the church, and that's why I think it was a very calculated and deliberate move by the Vatican to suggest that it's okay if extraterrestrial life exists. Now, why would they do that? This is a position that has remained unchanged for hundreds of years, and all of a sudden they're changing that opinion. I think it's highly fascinating.
Giorgio, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your insight. And hey, you know, much success with Ancient Aliens. It's going strong, and you know, another 10 years maybe, huh? I mean, all you got to do is keep working and writing dynamite topics, and away you go. I mean, there's so much.
Let me tell you, the only reason why we're on the air is because of the countless fans. Yeah, and you guys have made the show what it is, and I really appreciate all the love. And yes, I mean, if there's more we can talk about, we'll talk about it.
Fantastic. Hey, continued success. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. Giorgio is an interesting fellow, has a great bit of knowledge on the whole idea behind Ancient Aliens. So that was fun for me to enjoy too. That's it for today. Keep an eye on Facebook and what we're doing for the month of May and June, as well as the summertime. I have a lot of stuff going on. Have a great day.